"Think of it this way," Weiser recommenced 5 minutes later. They were in a new agey sort of diner called Daybreak Sundown. The place was a little too ferny for Ralph, who believed in old-fashioned diners that gleamed with chrome and smelled of grease. But the pie was good, and while the coffee was not up to Lois Chass's standards, Lois made the best cup he had ever tasted. It was hot and strong. "Which way is that?" Ralph asked. "There are certain things mankind, womankind too, keeps striving for. Not the stuff that gets written up in the history and civics books either, at least for the most part. I'm talking fundamentals here. A roof to keep the rain out, 3 hots in a cot, a decent sex life, healthy bowels. But maybe the most fundamental thing of all is what you've been missing, my friend. Because there's really nothing in the world that can measure up to a good night's sleep, is there?" "Boy, you got that right," Ralph said. Weiser nodded. "Sleep is the overlooked hero and the poor man's physician. Shakespeare said, it's the thread that knits up the raveled sleeves of care. Napoleon called it the blessed end of night. And Winston Churchill, one of the greatest insomniacs of the 20th century, said, it was the only relief he ever got from his deep depressions. I put all that stuff in my papers, but what all the quotes came down to is what I just said. Nothing in the whole wide world can measure up to a good night's sleep." "You've had the problem yourself, haven't you?" Ralph asked suddenly. "Is that why you, well, why you're taking me under your wing?" Joe Weiser grinned. "Is that what I'm doing?" "I think so, yes. Hey, I can live with that. The answer is yes. I've suffered from slow sleep insomnia ever since I was 13. It's why I ended up doing not just one research paper on the subject, but 2. How are you doing with it these days?" Weiser shrugged. "So far, it's been a pretty good year. Not the best, but I'll take it. For a couple of years in my early 20s, the problem was acute. I'd go to bed at 10, fall asleep around 4, get up at 7, and drag myself through the day feeling like a bit player in someone else's nightmare." This was so familiar to Ralph that his back and upper arms broke out in goosebumps. "Here comes the most important thing I can tell you, Ralph, so listen up." "I am. The thing you have to hang on to is that you're still basically okay, even though you feel like shit a lot of the time. All sleep is not created equal, you see? There's good sleep and bad sleep. If you're still having coherent dreams, and maybe even more importantly, lucid dreams, you're still having good sleep. And because of that, a script for sleeping pills could be about the worst thing in the world for you right now. And I know Litchfield. He's a nice enough guy, but he loves that prescription pad." "Say it twice," Ralph told him, thinking of Carolyn. "If you tell Litchfield what you told me while we were walking down here, he's going to prescribe a benzodiazepine, probably Dalmane or Restoril, maybe Halcyon or even Valium. You'll sleep, but you'll pay a price. Benzodiazepines are habit-forming. They're respiratory depressants, and worst of all, for guys like you and me, they significantly reduce REM sleep. Dreaming sleep, in other words. How's your pie? I only ask because you've hardly touched it." Ralph took a big bite and swallowed it, without tasting. "Good," he said. "Now tell me why you have to have dreams to make your sleep good sleep." "If I could answer that, I'd retire from the pill-pushing business and go into business as a sleep guru." Weiser had finished his pie and was now using the pad of his index finger to pick up the larger crumbs left on his plate. REM stands for rapid eye movements, of course, and the terms REM sleep and dreaming sleep have become synonymous in the public mind. But nobody really knows just how the eye movements of sleepers relate to the dreams they are having. It seems unlikely that the eye movements indicate watching or tracking, because sleep researchers see a lot of it even in dreams test subjects later describe as fairly static. Dreams of conversations, for instance, like the one we're having now. Similarly, no one really knows why there seems to be a clear relationship between lucid, coherent dreams and overall mental health. The more dreams of that sort a person has, the better off he seems to be. The less he has, the worse. There's a real scale there. Mental health's a pretty general phrase, Ralph said skeptically. Yeah, Weiser grinned. Makes me think of a bumper sticker I saw a few years back. Support mental health or I'll kill you. Anyway, we're talking about some basic measurable components. Cognitive ability, problem-solving ability, by both inductive and deductive methods. Ability to grasp relationships. Memory. My memory is lousy these days, Ralph said. He was thinking of his inability to remember the number of the cinema complex and his long hunt through the kitchen cabinet for the last cup of soup envelope. Yeah, you're probably suffering some short-term memory loss. But your fly is zipped, your shirt is on right side out, and I bet if I asked you what your middle name is, you could tell me. I'm not belittling your problem. I'd be the last person in the world to do that. But I am asking you to change your point of view for a minute or two. To think of all the areas in your life where you're still perfectly functional. All right. These lucid and coherent dreams, do they just indicate how well you're functioning? Like a gas gauge in a car? Or do they actually help you function? No one knows for sure, but the most likely answer is a little of both. In the late 50s, around the time the doctors were phasing out the barbiturates, the last really popular one was a fun drug called thalidomide. A few scientists even tried to suggest that the good sleep we've been beating our gums about and dreams aren't related. And? The tests don't support the hypothesis. People who stop dreaming or suffer from constant dream interruptions have all sorts of problems, including loss of cognitive ability and emotional stability. They also start to suffer perceptual problems like hyperreality. Beyond Weiser, at the far end of the counter, sat a fellow reading a copy of the Derry News. Only his hands and the top of his head were visible. He was wearing a rather ostentatious pinky ring on his left hand. The headline at the top of the front page read, "Abortion rights advocate agrees to speak in Derry next month." Below it, in slightly smaller type, was a subhead, "Pro-life groups promise organized protests." In the center of the page was a color picture of Susan Day, one that did her much more justice than the flat photographs on the poster he had seen in the window of Secondhand Rose, Secondhand Clothes. In those she had looked ordinary, perhaps even a little sinister. In this one she was radiant. Her long honey-blonde hair had been pulled back from her face. Her eyes were dark, intelligent, arresting. Hamilton Davenport's pessimism had been misplaced, it seemed. Susan Day was coming after all. Then Ralph saw something which made him forget all about Ham Davenport and Susan Day. A gray-blue aura had begun to gather around the hands of the man reading the newspaper and around the just visible crown of his head. It seemed particularly bright around the onyx pinky ring he wore. It did not obscure, but seemed to clarify, turning the ringstone into something that looked like an asteroid in a really realistic science fiction movie. "What did you say, Ralph?" "Hmm?" Ralph drew his gaze away from the newspaper reader's pinky ring with an effort. "I don't know. Was I talking? I guess I asked you what hyperreality is." "Heightened sensory awareness," Weiser said. "Like taking an LSD trip without having to ingest any chemicals." "Oh," Ralph said, watching as the bright gray-blue aura began to form complicated runic patterns on the nail of the finger Weiser was using to mash up crumbs. At first they looked like letters written in frost, then sentences written in fog, then odd, gasping faces. He blinked, and they were gone. "Ralph, you still there?" "Sure, you bet. But listen, Joe, if the folk remedies don't work, and the stuff in aisle 3 doesn't work, and the prescription drugs could actually make things worse instead of better, what does that leave?" "Nothing, right?" "You going to eat the rest of that?" Weiser said, pointing at Ralph's plate. Chilly gray-blue light drifted off the tip of his finger like Arabic letters written in dry ice vapor. "Nope, I'm full. Be my guest." Weiser pulled Ralph's plate to him. "Don't give up so fast," he said. I want you to come back to the farm with me so I can give you a couple of business cards. My advice as your friendly neighborhood drug pusher is that you give these guys a try. What guys? Ralph watched, fascinated, as Weiser opened his mouth to receive the last bite of pie. Each of his teeth was lit with a fierce gray glow. The fillings in his molars glowed like tiny suns. The fragments of crust and apple filling on his tongue crawled with lucid, Ralph, lucid, light. Then Weiser closed his mouth to chew, and the glow was gone. James Roy Hong and Anthony Forbes. Hong is an acupuncturist with offices on Kansas Street. Forbes is a hypnotist with a place over on the east side, Hesse Street, I think. And before you yell quack... I'm not going to yell quack, Ralph said quietly. His hand rose to touch the magic eye, which he was still wearing under his shirt. Believe me, I'm not. Okay, good. My advice is that you try Hong first. The needles look scary, but they only hurt a little, and he's got something going there. I don't know what the hell it is or how it works, but I do know that when I went through a bad patch 2 winters ago, he helped me a lot. Forbes is also good, so I've heard, but Hong's my pick. He's busy as hell, but I might be able to help you there. What do you say? Ralph saw a bright gray glow, no thicker than a thread, slip from the corner of Weiser's eye and slide down his cheek like a supernatural tear. It decided him. I say, let's go. Weiser clapped him on the shoulder. Good man, let's pay up and get out of here. He produced a quarter. Flip you for the check? Halfway back to the pharmacy, Weiser stopped to look at a poster which had been put up in the window of an empty storefront between the Rite Aid and the diner. Ralph only glanced at it. He'd seen it before, in the window of Secondhand Rose, Secondhand Clothes. Wanted for murder? Weiser marveled. People have lost all goddamn sense of perspective, do you know it? Yes, Ralph said, if we had tails, I think most of us would spend all day chasing them and trying to bite them off. The poster's bad enough, Weiser said indignantly. But look at this. He was pointing at something beside the poster, something which had been written in the dirt which coated the outside of the empty display window. Ralph leaned close to read the short message. Kill this cunt, it said. Below the words was an arrow pointing at the left-hand photo of Susan Day. Jesus, Ralph said quietly. Yeah, Weiser agreed. He pulled a handkerchief from his back pocket and wiped away the message, leaving in place of the words a bright, silvery fan shape, which Ralph knew only he could see. He followed Weiser to the rear of the pharmacy and stood in the doorway of an office, not much bigger than a public toilet cubicle, while Weiser sat on the only piece of furniture, a high stool that would have looked at home in Ebenezer Scrooge's counting house, and phoned the office of James Roy Hong, acupuncturist. Weiser pushed the phone speaker button so Ralph could follow the conversation. Hong's receptionist, someone named Audra, who seemed to know Weiser on a basis a good deal warmer than a merely professional one, at first said, Dr. Hong could not possibly see a new patient until after Thanksgiving. Ralph's shoulders slumped. Weiser raised an open palm in his direction. Wait a minute, Ralph. And then proceeded to talk Audra into finding, or perhaps creating, an opening for Ralph in early October. That was a month away, but a lot better than Thanksgiving. Thanks, Audra, Weiser said. We still on for dinner tonight? Yes, she said. Now turn off the damn speaker, Joe. I have something that's for your ears only. Weiser did it, listened, laughed until tears, to Ralph they looked like gorgeous liquid pearls, stood in his eyes. Then he smooched twice into the phone and hung up. You're all set, he said, handing Ralph a small white card with a time and date of the appointment written on the back. October 4th. Not great, but really the best she could do. Audra's good people. It's fine. Here's Anthony Forbes's card in case you want to call him in the interim. Thanks, Ralph said, taking the second card. I owe you. The only thing you owe me is a return visit so I can find out how it went. I'm concerned. There are doctors who won't prescribe anything for insomnia, you know. They like to say that no one ever died from lack of sleep. But I'm here to tell you that's crap. Ralph supposed this news should have frightened him, but he felt pretty steady, at least for the time being. The auras had gone away. The bright gray gleams in Wise's eyes as he laughed at whatever Hong's receptionist had said had been the last. He was starting to think they had just been a mental fugue brought on by a combination of extreme tiredness and Wise's mention of hyper-reality. There was another reason for feeling good. He now had an appointment with a man who had helped this man through a similar bad patch. Ralph thought he'd let Hong stick needles into him until he looked like a porcupine, if the treatment allowed him to sleep until the sun came up. And there was a third thing. The gray auras hadn't actually been scary. They'd been sort of interesting. People die from lack of sleep all the time, Weiser was saying, although the medical examiner usually ends up writing suicide on the cause of death line rather than insomnia. Insomnia and alcoholism have a lot in common, but the major thing is this. They're both diseases of the heart and mind, and when they're allowed to run their course, they usually gut the spirit long before they're able to destroy the body. So yeah, people do die from lack of sleep. This is a dangerous time for you, and you have to take care of yourself. If you start to feel really wonky, call Litchfield. Do you hear me? Don't stand on ceremony. Ralph grimaced. I think I'd be more apt to call you. Weiser nodded as if he had absolutely expected this. The number under Hong's is mine, he said. Surprised, Ralph looked down at the card again. There was a second number there, marked J.W. Day or night, Weiser said. Really, you won't disturb my wife. We've been divorced since 1983. Ralph tried to speak and found he couldn't. All that came out was a choked, meaningless little sound. He swallowed hard, trying to clear the obstruction in his throat. Weiser saw he was struggling and clapped him on the back. No bawling in the store, Ralph. It scares away the big spenders. You want a Kleenex? No, I'm okay. His voice was slightly watery, but audible and mostly under control. Weiser cast a critical eye on him. Not yet, but you will be. Weiser's big hand swallowed Ralph's once more, and this time Ralph didn't worry about it. For the time being, try to relax, and remember to be grateful for the sleep you do get. Okay. Thanks again. Weiser nodded and walked back to the prescription counter. Ralph walked back down aisle 3, turned left at the formidable condom display, and went out through a door with "Thank you for shopping at Rite Aid" decaled above the push bar. At first he thought there was nothing unusual about the fierce brightness that made him squint his eyes almost shut. It was midday, after all, and perhaps the drugstore had been a little darker than he had realized. Then he opened his eyes wide again, and his breath came to a dead stop in his throat. A look of thunderstruck amazement spread over his face. It was the expression an explorer might wear when, after pushing his way through just one more nondescript tangle of bushes, he finds himself looking at some fabulous lost city or brain-busting geological feature, a cliff of diamonds, perhaps, or a spiral waterfall. Ralph shrank back against the blue mailbox standing to one side of the drugstore's entrance, still not breathing, his eyes shuttling jerkily from left to right, as the brain behind them tried to understand the wonderful and terrible news it was receiving. The auras were back. But that was a little like saying Hawaii was a place where you didn't have to wear your overcoat. This time the light was everywhere, fierce and flowing, strange and beautiful. Ralph had had only one experience in his entire life which was remotely similar to this. During the summer of 1941, the year he'd turned 18, he'd been riding his thumb from Derry to his uncle's place in Poughkeepsie, New York, a distance of about 400 miles. An early evening thunderstorm at the end of his second day on the road had sent him scurrying for the nearest available shelter, a decrepit barn swaying drunkenly at the end of a long hayfield. He had spent more of that day walking than riding, and had fallen soundly asleep in one of the barn's long-abandoned horse stalls, even before the thunder had stopped blasting the sky overhead. He'd awakened at mid-morning the next day, after a solid 14 hours of sleep, and had looked around in utter wonder, not even sure in those first few moments where he was. He only knew it was some dark, sweet-smelling place, and that the world above and on all sides of him had been split open with brilliant seams of light. Then he had remembered taking shelter in the barn, and it came to him that this strange vision had been caused by the cracks in the barn's walls and roof, combined with the bright summer sunlight. Only that, and nothing more. Yet he'd sat there in mute wonder for at least 5 minutes just the same, a wide-eyed teenage boy with hay in his hair and his arms dusted with chaff. He sat there looking up at the tidal gold of dust motes spinning lazily in the slanting cross-hatching rays of the sun. He remembered thinking it had been like being in church. This was that experience to the 10th power, and the hell of it was simply this. He could not describe exactly what had happened, and how the world had changed to make it so wonderful. Things and people, particularly the people, had auras, yes, but that was only where this amazing phenomenon began. Things had never been so brilliant, so utterly and completely there. The cars, the telephone poles, the shopping carts in the cart corral in front of the supermarket, the frame apartment buildings across the street. All these things seemed to pop out at him like 3D images in an old film. All at once, this dingy little strip mall on Wycham Street had become Wonderland, and although Ralph was looking right at it, he was not sure of what he was looking at, only that it was rich and gorgeous and fabulously strange. The only things he could isolate were the auras surrounding the people going in and out of stores, stowing packages in their trunks, or getting in their cars and driving away. Some of these auras were brighter than others, but even the dimmest were 100 times brighter than his first glimpses of the phenomenon. But it's what Weiser was talking about, no doubt of that. It's hyper-reality, and what you're looking at is no more there than the hallucinations of people who are under the influence of LSD. What you're seeing is just another symptom of your insomnia, no more and no less. Look at it, Ralph, and marvel over it as much as you want. It is marvelous. Just don't believe it. He didn't need to tell himself to marvel, however. There were marvels everywhere. A bakery truck was backing out of a slot in front of Daybreak Sundown, and a bright maroon substance, it was almost the color of dried blood, came from its tailpipe. It was neither smoke nor vapor, but had some of the characteristics of each. This brightness rose in gradually attenuating spikes, like the lines of an EEG readout. Ralph looked down at the pavement and saw the tread of the van's tires printed on the concrete in that same maroon shade. The van speeded up as it left the parking lot, and the ghostly graph trail, emerging with its exhaust, turned the bright red of arterial blood as it did. There were similar oddities everywhere, phenomena which intersected in slanting paths and made Ralph think again of how the light had come slanting through the cracks in the roof and walls of that long-ago barn. But the real wonder was the people, and it was around them that the auras seemed most clearly defined and real. A bag boy came out of the supermarket, pushing a cartload of groceries, and walking in a nimbus of such brilliant white that it was like a traveling spotlight. The aura of the woman beside him was dingy by comparison, the gray-green of cheese which has begun to mold. A young girl called to the bag boy from the open window of a Subaru and waved. Her left hand left bright contrails, as pink as cotton candy in the air as it moved. They began to fade almost as soon as they appeared. The bag boy grinned and waved back. His hand left a fantail of yellowish-white behind. To Ralph it looked like the fin of a tropical fish. This also began to fade, but more slowly. Ralph's fear at this confused, shining vision was considerable. But for the time being, at least, fear had taken a back seat to wonder, awe, and simple amazement. It was more beautiful than anything he'd ever seen in his life. "But it's not real," he cautioned himself. "Remember that, Ralph." He promised himself he would try, but for the time being, that cautioning voice seemed very far away. Now he noticed something else. There was a line of that lucid brightness emerging from the head of every person he could see. It trailed upward like a ribbon of bunting or brightly colored crepe paper until it attenuated and disappeared. For some people, the point of disappearance was 5 feet above the head. For others, it was 10 or 15. In most cases, the color of the bright ascending line matched the rest of the aura. Bright white for the bag boy, gray-green in the case of the female customer beside him, for instance. But there were some striking exceptions. Ralph saw a rust-red line rising from a middle-aged man who was striding along in the middle of a dark blue aura, and a woman with a light gray aura whose ascending line was an amazing and slightly alarming shade of magenta. In some cases, two or three, not a lot, the rising lines were almost black. Ralph didn't like those, and he noticed that the people to whom these balloon strings, they were named just that simply and quickly in his mind, belonged, invariably looked unwell. Of course they do. The balloon strings are an indicator of health, and ill health in some cases. Like the Curlian auras people were so fascinated with back in the late 60s and early 70s. Ralph, another voice warned, you are not really seeing these things, okay? I mean, I hate to be a bore, but... But wasn't it at least possible that the phenomenon was real? That his persistent insomnia, coupled with the stabilizing influence of his lucid, coherent dreams, had afforded him a glimpse of a fabulous dimension just beyond the reach of ordinary perception? Quit it, Ralph, and right now. You have to do better than that, or you'll end up in the same boat as poor old Ed Deepnow. Thinking of Ed kicked off some association, something he'd said on the day he'd been arrested for beating his wife. But before Ralph could isolate it, a voice spoke almost at his left elbow. Mom? Mommy? Can we get the Honey Nut Cheerios again? We'll see, once we get inside, hon. A young woman and a little boy passed in front of him, walking hand in hand. It was the boy who looked to be 4 or 5 who had spoken. His mother was walking in an envelope of almost blinding white. The balloon string rising out of her blonde hair was also white and very wide, more like the ribbon on a fancy gift box than a string. It rose to a height of at least 20 feet and floated out slightly behind her as she walked. It made Ralph think of things bridal, trains, veils, gauzy billows of skirt. Her son's aura was a healthy dark blue verging on violet, and as the two of them walked past, Ralph saw a fascinating thing. Tendrils of aura were also rising from their clasped hands, white from the woman, dark blue from the boy. They twined in a pigtail as they rose, faded, and disappeared. Mother and son, Ralph thought. There was something perfectly, simply symbolic about those bands, which were wrapped around each other like woodbine climbing a garden stake. Looking at them made his heart rejoice. Corny, but it was exactly how he felt. Mother and son, blue and white, mother and... Mom, what's that man looking at? The blonde-haired woman's glance at Ralph was brief, but he saw the way her lips thinned down and pressed together before she turned away. More importantly, he saw the brilliant aura which surrounded her suddenly darken, close in, and pick up spiraling tints of dark red. That's the color of fright, Ralph thought. Or maybe anger. I don't know, Tim. Come on, stop dawdling. She began to move him along faster, her ponytailed hair flipping back and forth and leaving small fans of gray tinged with red in the air. To Ralph, they looked like the arcs that wipers sometimes left on dirty windshields. Hey, Mom, get a life! Quit pulling! The little boy had to trot in order to keep up. That's my fault, Ralph thought, and an image of how he must have looked to the young mother flashed into his mind. Old guy, tired face, big purplish pouches under his eyes. He's standing, hunching, by the mailbox outside the Rite Aid pharmacy, staring at her and her little boy as if they were the most remarkable things in the world. Which you just about are, ma'am, if you but knew it. To her, he must have looked like the biggest pervo of all time. He had to get rid of this. Real or hallucination, it didn't matter. He had to make it quit. If he didn't, somebody was going to call either the cops or the men with the butterfly nets. For all he knew, the pretty mother could be making the bank of payphones just inside the market's main doors her first stop. He was just asking himself how one thought away something which was all in one's mind to begin with, when he realized it had already happened. Psychic phenomenon, or sensory hallucination. It had simply disappeared while he'd been thinking about how awful he must have looked to the pretty young mother. The day had gone back to its previous Indian summery brilliance, which was wonderful but still a long way from that pellucid, all-pervading glow. The people crisscrossing the parking lot of the strip mall were just people again. No auras, no balloon strings, no fireworks. Just people on their way to buy groceries in the Shop and Save, or to pick up their last batch of summer pictures at Photomat, or to grab a takeout coffee from daybreak sundown. Some of them might even be ducking into the Rite Aid for a box of Trojans, or, God bless us and keep us, a sleeping aid. Just your ordinary, everyday citizens of Derry going about their ordinary, everyday business. Ralph released pent-up breath in a gusty sigh and braced himself for a wave of relief. Relief did come, but not in the tidal wave he had expected. There was no sense of having drawn back from the brink of madness in the nick of time. No sense of having been close to any sort of brink. Yet he understood perfectly well that he couldn't live for long in a world that bright and wonderful without endangering his sanity. It would be like having an orgasm which lasted for hours. That might be how geniuses and great artists experienced things, but it was not for him. So much juice would blow his fuses in short order, and when the men with the butterfly nets rolled up to give him a shot and take him away, he would probably be happy to go. The most readily identifiable emotion he was feeling just now wasn't relief, but a species of pleasant melancholy, which he remembered sometimes experiencing after sex when he was a very young man. This melancholy was not deep, but it was wide, seeming to fill the empty places of his body and mind the way a receding flood leaves a scrim of loose, rich topsoil. He wondered if he would ever have such an alarming, exhilarating moment of epiphany again. He thought the chances were fairly good, at least until next month, when James Roy Hong got his needles into him, or perhaps until Anthony Forbes started swinging his gold pocket watch in front of his eyes and telling him he was getting very sleepy. It was possible that neither Hong nor Forbes would have any success in curing his insomnia, but if one of them did, Ralph guessed he would stop seeing auras and balloon strings after his first good night's sleep. And after a month or so of restful nights, he would probably forget this had ever happened. As far as he was concerned, that was a perfectly good reason to feel a touch of melancholy. You better get moving, buddy. If your new friend happens to look out the drugstore window and sees you still standing here like a dope, he'll probably send for the men with the nets himself. Call Dr. Litchfield, more like it, Ralph muttered, and cut across the parking lot toward Harris Avenue. He poked his head through Lois's front door and called. Yo, anybody home? Come on in, Ralph, Lois called back. We're in the living room. Ralph had always imagined a hobbit hole would be a lot like Lois Chass's little house half a block or so down the hill from the Red Apple. Neat and crowded, a little too dark, perhaps, but scrupulously clean. And he guessed a hobbit like Bilbo Baggins, whose interest in his ancestors was eclipsed only by his interest in what might be for dinner, would have been enchanted by the tiny living room, where relatives looked down from every wall. The place of honor on top of the television was held by a tinted studio photograph of the man Lois always referred to as Mr. Chass. McGovern was sitting hunched forward on the couch, with a plate of macaroni and cheese balanced on his bony knees. The television was on, and a game show was clattering through the bonus round. "What does she mean, we're in the living room?" Ralph asked. But before McGovern could answer, Lois came in with a steaming plate in her hands. "Here," she said, "sit down, eat. I talked with Simone, and she said it'll probably be on news at noon." "Gee, Lois, you didn't have to do this," he said, taking the plate. But his stomach demurred strongly when he got his first smell of onions and mellow cheddar. He glanced at the clock on the wall, just visible between photos of a man in a raccoon coat and a woman who looked as if Vodo Diodo might have been in her vocabulary, and was astounded to see that it was 12:05. "I didn't do anything but stick some leftovers into the microwave," she said. "Someday, Ralph, I'll cook for you. Now sit down." "Not on my hat, though," McGovern said, without taking his eyes from the bonus round. He picked the fedora up off the couch, dropped it on the floor beside him, and went back to his own portion of the casserole, which was disappearing rapidly. "This is very tasty, Lois. Thank you." She paused long enough to watch one of the contestants bag a trip to Barbados and a new car, then hurried back into the kitchen. The screaming winner faded out and was replaced by a man in wrinkled pajamas, tossing and turning in bed. He sat up and looked at the clock on the nightstand. It said 3:18 a.m., a time of day with which Ralph had become very familiar. "Can't sleep?" an announcer asked sympathetically. "Tired of lying awake night after night?" A small glowing pill came gliding in through the insomniac's bedroom window. To Ralph, it looked like the world's smallest flying saucer, and he wasn't surprised to see that it was blue. Ralph sat down beside McGovern. Although both men were quite slim, scrawny might actually have described the pill better, between them they used up most of the couch. Lois came in with her own plate and sat down in the rocker by the window. Over the canned music and studio applause that marked the end of the game show, a woman's voice said, "This is Lizette Benson. Topping our news at noon, a well-known women's rights advocate agrees to speak in Derry, sparking a protest and 6 arrests at a local clinic. We'll also have Chris Altenberg's weather and Bob McClanahan on sports. Stay tuned." Ralph forked a bite of macaroni and cheese into his mouth, looked up, and saw Lois watching him. "All right?" she asked. "Delicious," he said, and it was. But he thought that right now a big helping of Franco-American spaghetti served cold right out of the can would have tasted just as good. He wasn't just hungry, he was ravenous. Seeing auras apparently burned a lot of calories. "What happened, very briefly, was this," McGovern said, swallowing the last of his own lunch and putting the plate down next to his hat. "About 18 people showed up outside Woman Care at 8:30 this morning, while people were arriving for work. Lois's friend Simone says they're calling themselves the Friends of Life. But the core group are the assorted fruits and nuts that used to go by the name of Daily Bread. She said one of them was Charles Pickering, the guy the cops caught apparently getting ready to firebomb the joint late last year. Simone's niece said the police only arrested 4 people. It looks like she was a little low." "Was Ed really with them?" Ralph asked. "Yes," Lois said, "and he got arrested too. At least no one got maced. That was just a rumor. No one got hurt at all." "This time," McGovern added darkly. The News at Noon logo appeared on Lois's hobbit-sized color TV, then dissolved into Lizette Benson. "Good afternoon," she said. "Topping our news on this beautiful late summer day, prominent writer and controversial women's rights advocate Susan Day agrees to speak at Derry's Civic Center next month. And the announcement of her speech sparks a demonstration at Woman Care, the Derry Women's Resource Center and Abortion Clinic, which has so polarized..." "There they go with that abortion clinic stuff again," McGovern exclaimed. "Jesus!" "Hush," Lois said in a peremptory tone, not much like her usual tentative murmur. McGovern gave her a surprised look and hushed. "John Kirkland at Woman Care, with the first of 2 reports." Lizette Benson was finishing, and the picture switched to a reporter doing a stand-up outside a long, low brick building. A super at the bottom of the screen informed viewers that this was a live-eye report. A strip of windows ran along one side of Woman Care. 2 of them were broken, and several others were smeared with red stuff that looked like blood. Yellow police line tape had been strung between the reporter and the building. 3 uniformed Derry cops and 1 plainclothesman stood in a little group on the far side of it. Ralph was not very surprised to recognize the detective as John Lydecker. "They call themselves the Friends of Life, Lizette, and they claim their demonstration this morning was a spontaneous outpouring of indignation, prompted by the news that Susan Day, the woman radical pro-life group's nationwide call America's number 1 baby killer, is coming to Derry next month to speak at the Civic Center. At least 1 Derry police officer believes that's not quite the way it was, however." Kirkland's report went to tape, beginning with a close-up of Lydecker, who seemed resigned to the microphone in his face. "There was no spontaneity about this," he said. "Clearly a lot of preparation went into it. They've probably been sitting on advance word of Susan Day's decision to come here and speak for most of the week, just getting ready and waiting for the news to break in the paper. which it did this morning. The camera went to a two-shot. Kirkland was giving Lydecker his most penetrating Geraldo look. "What do you mean, a lot of preparation?" he asked. "Most of the signs they were carrying had Miss Day's name on them. Also, there were over a dozen of these." A surprisingly human emotion slipped through Lydecker's policeman being interviewed mask. Ralph thought it was distaste. He raised a large plastic evidence bag, and for one horrified instant, Ralph was positive that there was a mangled and bloody baby inside. Then he realized that, whatever the red stuff might be, the body in the evidence bag was a doll's body. "They didn't buy these at Kmart," Lydecker told the TV reporter. "I guarantee you that." The next shot was a long-lens close-up of the smeared and broken windows. The camera panned them slowly. The stuff on the smeared ones looked more like blood than ever, and Ralph decided he didn't want the last two or three bites of his macaroni and cheese. The demonstrators came with baby dolls whose soft bodies had been injected with what police believed to be a mixture of Karo syrup and red food coloring, Kirkland said in voiceover. They flung the dolls at the side of the building as they chanted anti-Susan Day slogans. Two windows were broken, but there was no major damage. The camera stopped, centering on a gruesomely smeared pane of glass. "Most of the dolls split open," Kirkland was saying, splattering a substance that looked enough like blood to badly frighten the employees who witnessed the bombardment. The shot of the red smeared window was replaced by one of a lovely dark-haired woman in slacks and a pullover. "Oh, look, it's Bobby," Lois cried. "Golly, I hope Simone's watching. Maybe I ought to..." It was McGovern's turn to say hush. "I was terrified," Barbara Richards told Kirkland. "At first I thought they were really throwing dead bodies, or maybe fetuses they'd gotten hold of somehow. Even after Dr. Harper ran through, yelling they were only dolls, I still wasn't sure." "You said they were chanting?" Kirkland asked. "Yes, what I heard most clearly was, 'Keep the angel of death out of Derry.'" The report now reverted to Kirkland in his live stand-up mode. The demonstrators were ferried from woman care to the Derry police station on Main Street around 9 o'clock this morning, Lizette. "I understand that 12 were questioned and released. 6 others were arrested on charges of malicious mischief, a misdemeanor. So it seems that another shot in Derry's continuing war over abortion has been fired. This is John Kirkland, Channel 4 News." "Another shot in..." McGovern began and threw up his hands. Lizette Benson was back on the screen. "We now go to Ann Rivers, who talked less than an hour ago to 2 of the so-called Friends of Life who were arrested in this morning's demonstration." Ann Rivers was standing on the steps of the Main Street cop shop with Ed Deepnow on one side and a tall, sallow, goateed individual on the other. Ed was looking natty and downright handsome in a gray tweed jacket and navy slacks. The tall man with a goatee was dressed as only a liberal with daydreams of what he might think of as the main proletariat could dress. Faded jeans, faded blue work shirt, wide red fireman's suspenders. It took Ralph only a second to place him. It was Dan Dalton, owner of Secondhand Rose Secondhand Clothes. The last time Ralph had seen him, he'd been standing behind the hanging guitars and birdcages in his shop window, flapping his hands at Ham Davenport in a gesture that said, "Who gives a shit what you think?" But it was Ed his eyes were drawn back to, of course. Ed, who looked natty and put together in more ways than one. McGovern apparently felt the same. "My God, I can't believe it's the same man," he murmured. "Lizette," the good-looking blonde was saying, "with me I have Edward Deepnow and Daniel Dalton, both of Derry, 2 of those arrested in this morning's demonstration. That's correct, gentlemen? You were arrested?" They nodded, Ed with a barest twinkle of humor, Dalton with dour, jut-jawed determination. The gaze the latter fixed on Ann Rivers made him look, to Ralph at least, as if he were trying to remember which abortion clinic he had seen her hurrying into, head down and shoulders hunched. "Have you been released on bail?" "We were released on our own recognizance," Ed answered. "The charges were minor. It was not our intention to hurt anyone, and no one was hurt. We were arrested only because the godless entrenched power structure in this town wants to make an example of us, Dalton said. And Ralph thought he saw a minute wince momentarily tighten Ned's face. There he goes again, expression. Ann Rivers swung the mic back to Ed. The major issue here isn't philosophical, but practical, he said. Although the people who run woman care like to concentrate on their counseling services, therapy services, free mammograms, and other such admirable functions, there's another side to the place. Rivers of blood run out of woman care. Innocent blood, Dalton cried. His eyes glowed in his long, lean face, and Ralph had a disturbing insight. All over eastern Maine, people were watching this and deciding that the man in the red suspenders was crazy, while his partner seemed like a pretty reasonable fellow. It was almost funny. Ed treated Dalton's interjection as the pro-life equivalent of hallelujah, giving it a single respectful beat before speaking again. The slaughter at woman care has been going on for nearly 8 years now, Ed told her. Many people, especially radical feminists like Dr. Roberta Harper, woman care's chief administrator, like to gild the lily with phrases like early termination. But what she's talking about is abortion, the ultimate act of abuse against women by a sexist society. But is lobbing dolls loaded with fake blood against the windows of a private clinic the way to put your views before the public, Mr. Deepnow? For a moment, just a moment, there and gone, the twinkle of good humor in Ed's eyes was replaced by a flash of something much harder and colder. For that one moment, Ralph was again looking at the Ed Deepnow, who had been ready to take on a truck driver who outweighed him by 100 pounds. Ralph forgot that what he was watching had been taped an hour ago and was afraid for the slim blonde, who was almost as pretty as the woman to whom her interview subject was still married. Be careful, young lady, Ralph thought. Be careful and be afraid. You're standing next to a very dangerous man. Then the flash was gone, and the man in the tweed coat was once more just an earnest young fellow who had followed his conscience to jail. Once more it was Dalton, now nervously snapping his suspenders like big red rubber bands, who looked a few sandwiches shy of a picnic. What we're doing is what the so-called good Germans failed to do in the 30s, Ed was saying. He spoke in the patient, lecturally tones of a man who has been forced to point this out over and over, mostly to those who should already know it. They were silent and 6 million Jews died. In this country, a similar Holocaust. Over 1,000 babies every day, Dalton said. His former shrillness had departed. He sounded horrified and desperately tired. Many of them are ripped from the wombs of their mothers in pieces, with their little arms waving in protest, even as they die. Oh, good God, McGovern said. That's the most ridiculous thing I have ever... Hush, Bill, Lois said sternly. Purpose of this protest? Rivers was asking Dalton. As you probably know, Dalton said, the city council has agreed to re-examine the zoning regulations that allow woman care to operate where it does and how it does. They could vote on the issue as early as November. The abortion rights people are afraid the council might throw sand in the gears of their death machine. So they've summoned Susan Day, this country's most notorious pro-abortion advocate, to try and keep the machine running. We are marshaling our forces. The pendulum of the microphone swung back to Ed. Will there be more protests, Mr. Deepnow? She asked. And Ralph suddenly had an idea she might be interested in him in a way which was not strictly professional. Hey, why not? Ed was a good-looking guy, and Miss Rivers could hardly know that he believed the Crimson King and his centurions were in Derry, joining forces with the baby killers at woman care. Until the legal aberration which opened the door to this slaughter has been corrected, the protests will continue, Ed replied, and we'll go on hoping that the histories of the next century will record that not all Americans were good Nazis during this dark period of our history. Violent protests? It's violence we oppose. The two of them were now maintaining strong eye contact, and Ralph thought Ann Rivers had what Carolyn would have called a case of hot thighs. Dan Dalton was standing off to one side of the screen, all but forgotten. And when Susan Day comes to Derry next month, can you guarantee her safety? Ed smiled, and in his mind's eye, Ralph saw him as he had been on that hot August afternoon less than a month ago, kneeling with one hand planted on either side of Ralph's shoulders and breathing, "They burn the fetuses over in Newport," into his face. Ralph shivered. In a country where thousands of children are sucked from the wombs of their mothers by the medical equivalent of industrial vacuum cleaners, I don't believe anyone can guarantee anything, Ed replied. Anne Rivers looked at him uncertainly for a moment, as if deciding whether or not she wanted to ask another question, maybe for his telephone number, and then turned back to face the camera. "This is Anne Rivers at Derry Police Headquarters," she said. Lizette Benson reappeared, and something in the bemused cast of her mouth made Ralph think that perhaps he hadn't been the only one to sense the attraction between interviewer and interviewee. "We'll be following this story all day," she said. "Be sure to tune in at 6 for further updates. In Augusta, Governor Greta Powers responded to charges that she may have..." Lois got up and pushed the off button on the TV. She simply stared at the darkening screen for a moment, then sighed heavily and sat down. "I have blueberry compote," she said. "But after that, do either of you want any?" Both men shook their heads. McGovern looked at Ralph and said, "That was scary." Ralph nodded. He kept thinking of how Ed had gone striding back and forth through the spray thrown by the lawn sprinkler, breaking the rainbows with his body, pounding his fist into his open palm. How could they let him out on bail and then interview him on the news as if he was a normal human being? Lois asked indignantly. After what he did to poor Helen? My God, that Anne Rivers looked ready to invite him home to dinner. Or to eat crackers in bed with her, Ralph said dryly. The assault charge and this stuff today are entirely different matters, McGovern said. And you can bet your boots the lawyer or lawyers these yo-yos have got on retainer will be sure to keep it that way. And even the assault charge was only a misdemeanor, Ralph reminded her. How can assault be a misdemeanor? Lois asked. I'm sorry, but I never did understand that part. It's a misdemeanor when you only do it to your wife, McGovern said, hoisting his satiric eyebrow. It's the American way, Lo. She twisted her hands together restlessly, took Mr. Chass down from the television, looked at him for a moment, then put him back and resumed twisting her hands. Well, the law's one thing, she said, and I'd be the first to admit that I don't understand it all. But somebody ought to tell them he's crazy, that he's a wife-beater, and he's crazy. You don't know how crazy, Ralph said. And for the first time he told them the story of what had happened the previous summer out by the airport. It took about 10 minutes. When he finished, neither of them said anything. They only looked at him with wide eyes. What? Ralph asked uneasily. You don't believe me? You think I imagined it? Of course I believe it, Lois said. I was just, well, stunned and frightened. Ralph, I think maybe you ought to pass that story on to John Lydecker, McGovern said. I don't think he can do a goddamn thing with it, but considering Ed's new playmates, I think it's information he should have. Ralph thought it over carefully, then nodded and pushed himself to his feet. No time like the present, he said. Want to come, Lois? She thought it over, then shook her head. I'm tired out, she said, and a little, what do the kids call it these days? A little freaked. I think I'll put my feet up for a bit. Take a nap. You do that, Ralph said. You do look a little tuckered. And thanks for feeding us. Impulsively, he bent over her and kissed the corner of her mouth. Lois looked up at him with startled gratitude. Ralph turned off his own television a little over 6 hours later, as Lizette Benson finished the evening news and handed off to the sports guy. The demonstration at WomanCare had been bumped to the number 2 slot. The evening's big story was the continuing allegations that Governor Greta Powers had used cocaine as a grad student. And there was nothing new except that Dan Dalton was now being identified as the head of the Friends of Life. Ralph thought figurehead was probably a better word. Was Ed actually in charge yet? If he wasn't, Ralph guessed he would be before long, Christmas at the latest. A potentially more interesting question was what Ed's employers thought about Ed's legal adventures up the road in Derry. Ralph had an idea they would be a lot less comfortable with what had gone on today than with last month's domestic abuse charge. He had read only recently that Hawking Labs would soon become the fifth such research center in the Northeast to be working with fetal tissue. They probably wouldn't applaud the information that one of their research chemists had been arrested for chucking dolls filled with fake blood at the side of a clinic that did abortions. And if they knew how crazy he really was. Who's going to tell them, Ralph? You? No, that was a step further than he was willing to go, at least for the time being. Unlike going down to the police station with McGovern to talk to John Lydecker about the incident last summer, it felt like persecution. Like writing, "Kill this cunt," beside a picture of a woman with whose views you didn't agree. That's bullshit, and you know it. "I don't know anything," he said, getting up and going to the window. "I'm too tired to know anything." But as he stood there, looking across the street at two men coming out of the Red Apple with a six-pack apiece, he suddenly did know something, remembered something, that drew a cold line up his back. This morning, when he had come out of the Rite Aid and been overwhelmed by the auras, and a sense of having stepped up to some new level of awareness, he had reminded himself again and again to enjoy but not to believe, that if he failed to make that crucial distinction, he was apt to end up in the same boat as Ed Deepnow. That thought had almost opened the door on some associative memory, but the shifting auras in the parking lot had pulled him away from it before it had been able to kick all the way in. Now it came to him. Ed had said something about seeing auras, hadn't he? No, he might have meant auras, but the word he actually used was colors. I'm almost positive of that. It was right after he talked about seeing the corpses of babies every place, even on the roofs. He said, Ralph watched the two men get into a beat-up old van and thought that he would never be able to remember Ed's words exactly. He was just too tired. Then, as the van drove off, trailing a cloud of exhaust that reminded him of the bright maroon stuff he'd seen coming from the tailpipe of the bakery truck that noon, another door opened, and the memory did come. He said that sometimes the world is full of colors, Ralph told his empty apartment, but that at some point they all started turning black. I think that was it. It was close, but was it everything? Ralph thought there had been at least a little more to Ed's spiel, but he couldn't remember what. And did it matter anyway? His nerves suggested strongly that it did. The cold line up his back had both widened and deepened. Behind him, the telephone rang. Ralph turned and saw it sitting in a bath of baleful red light, dark red, the color of nosebleeds and cocks, fighting cocks, rooster combs. No, part of his mind moaned. Oh, no, Ralph, don't get going on this again. Each time the phone rang, the envelope of light got brighter. During the intervals of silence, it darkened. It was like looking at a ghostly heart with a telephone inside it. Ralph closed his eyes tightly, and when he opened them again, the red aura around the telephone was gone. No, you just can't see it right now. I'm not sure, but I think you might have willed it away, like something in a lucid dream. As he crossed the room to the telephone, he told himself, and in no uncertain terms, that that idea was as crazy as seeing the auras in the first place. Except it wasn't, and he knew it wasn't. Because if it was crazy, how come it had taken only one look at that rooster-red halo of light to make him sure that it was Ed Deepnow calling? That's crap, Ralph. You think it's Ed because Ed's on your mind, and because you're so tired your head's getting funny. Go on, pick it up, you'll see. It's not the telltale heart, not even the telltale phone. It's probably some guy wanting to sell you subscriptions, or the lady at the blood bank wondering why you haven't been in lately. Except he knew better. Ralph picked up the phone and said hello. No answer. But someone was there. Ralph could hear breathing. Hello? He asked again. There was still no immediate answer, and he was about to say, I'm hanging up now, when Ed Deepnow said, I called about your mouth, Ralph. It's trying to get you in trouble. The line of cold between his shoulder blades was no longer a line. Now it was a thin plate of ice covering him from the nape of his neck to the small of his back. Hello, Ed. I saw you on the news today. It was the only thing he could think of to say. His hand did not seem to be holding the phone so much as to be cramped around it. Never mind that, old boy. Just pay attention. I've had a visit from that wide detective who arrested me last month, Lydecker. He just left, in fact. Ralph's heart sank, but not as far as he might have feared. After all, Lydecker's going to see Ed wasn't that surprising, was it? He'd been very interested in Ralph's story of the airport confrontation in the summer of 92. Very interested indeed. Did he? Ralph asked evenly. Detective Lydecker has the idea that I think people, or possibly supernatural beings of some sort, are trucking fetuses out of town in flatbeds and pickup trucks. What a scream, huh? Ralph stood beside the sofa, pulling the telephone cord restlessly through his fingers and realizing that he could see dull red light creeping out of the wire like sweat. The light pulsed with the rhythms of Ed's speech. You've been telling tales out of school, old boy. Ralph was silent. Calling the police after I gave that bitch the lesson she so richly deserved didn't bother me, Ed told him. I put it down to, well, grandfatherly concern. Or maybe you thought that if she was grateful enough, she might actually spare you a mercy fuck. After all, you're old but not exactly ready for Jurassic Park yet. You might have thought she'd let you get a finger into her at the very least. Ralph said nothing. Right, old boy? Ralph said nothing. You think you're going to rattle me with a silent treatment? Forget it. But Ed did sound rattled, thrown off his stride. It was as if he had made the call with a certain script in his head, and Ralph was refusing to read his lines. You can't. You better not. My calling the police after you beat Helen didn't upset you, but your conversation with Lydecker today obviously did. Why's that, Ed? Are you finally starting to have some questions about your behavior? And your thinking, maybe? It was Ed's turn to be silent. At last he whispered harshly, If you don't take this seriously, Ralph, it would be the worst mistake. Oh, I take it seriously, Ralph said. I saw what you did today, and I saw what you did out by the airport a year ago. Now the police know. I listen to you, Ed. Now you listen to me. You're ill. You've had some sort of mental breakdown. You're having delusions. I don't have to listen to your crap, Ed nearly screamed. No, you don't. You can hang up. It's your dime after all. But until you do, I'm going to keep hammering away. Because I liked you, Ed, and I want to like you again. You're a bright guy, delusions or no delusions. And I think you can understand me. Lydecker knows, and Lydecker is going to be watching you. Are you seeing the colors yet? Ed asked. His voice had become calm again. At the same instant, the red glow around the telephone wire popped out of existence. What colors? Ralph asked at last. Ed ignored the question. You said you liked me? Well, I like you, too. I've always liked you. So I'm going to give you some very valuable advice. You're drifting into deep water, and there are things swimming around in the undertow you can't even conceive of. You think I'm crazy? But I want to tell you that you don't know what madness is. You don't have the slightest idea. You will, though, if you keep on meddling in things that don't concern you. Take my word for it. What things? Ralph asked. He tried to keep his voice light, but he was still squeezing the telephone receiver tight enough to make his fingers throb. Forces, Ed replied. There are forces at work in Derry that you don't want to know about. There are... Well, let's just say there are entities. They haven't really noticed you yet, but if you keep fooling with me, they will. And you don't want that. Believe me, you don't. Forces? Entities? You asked me how I found out about all this stuff. Who brought me into the picture? Do you remember that, Ralph? Yes, he did too. Now, That had been the last thing Ed had said to him before turning on the big game show grin and going over to greet the cops. "I've seen the colors since he came and told me. We'll talk about it later. The doctor told me. The little bald doctor. I think it's him you'll have to answer to if you try to mind my business again. And then God help you." "The little bald doctor, uh-huh," Ralph said. "Yes, I see. First the Crimson King and the Centurions, now the little bald doctor. I suppose next it'll be..." "Spare me your sarcasm, Ralph. Just stay away from me and my interests. Do you hear?"
"Stay away."
There was a click, and Ed was gone. Ralph looked at the telephone in his hand for a long time, then slowly hung it up. "Just stay away from me and my interests?" Yes, and why not? He had plenty of his own fish to fry. Ralph walked slowly into the kitchen, stuck a TV dinner, fillet of haddock, as a matter of fact, into the oven, and tried to put abortion protests, auras, Ed Deepnow, and the Crimson King out of his mind. It was easier than he would have expected.